Hi there, Carolyn and Marco here.
Thank you for tuning into the world.
Before we get to the show, we wanted to quickly remind you that we have a fundraising drive happening right now until June 14th, and we could use your help to meet our goal of raising $25,000.
We've enjoyed hearing from some of you over the past few weeks with your kind words along with your financial support. Laurel wrote in to say, "The world is always the highlight of my day. Thank you for sharing stories that make me think, question, and pause."
I love that. Think, question, pause. Now we are asking you to be a little bit more like Laurel and support us at The World in whatever way you can. Visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make a donation.
That's theworld.org/give. It means so much to all of us. Thank you. Hey there, a quick favor. We are conducting an audience survey, and we'd be really grateful if you could take just a few minutes and answer some questions in the survey. Please visit survey.prx.org/world to take the survey today. Again, that's survey.prx.org/world. And thank you. Israel and Hezbollah in the south of Lebanon are moving closer to war. Caught in the middle is the Lebanese government.
There's a lot of us don't support what Hezbollah is doing in the south, but it does mean we go to war with Hezbollah.
We'll hear more today from Lebanon's top diplomat. I'm Marco Werman. Also today, gains for the far right in Europe's parliamentary elections. Mainstream centrist parties are also patting themselves on the back for not getting trounced worse.
We are the anchor of stability, and voters recognized our leadership during the last 5 years.
And then a visit to a restaurant in Mexico City that's reaching way back in the country's culinary history.
El común denominador es el hongo.
The common denominator at this eatery, mushrooms. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us today. We begin this Monday in Israel, where a high-level resignation has led to political turmoil. Benny Gantz and his centrist National Unity Party over the weekend quit Israel's emergency wartime government. Gantz had threatened to resign if Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu did not change his strategy for the war in Gaza. And now Gantz is making good on that promise. His resignation came one day after a daring daylight raid by the Israeli military ended with the release of four hostages. That also came at the cost of dozens of Palestinian lives, according to Gaza's health ministry. To help us sort through what all this means, we reached out to Israeli journalist Noga Tarnopolsky in Jerusalem. So much to talk about today, Noga, but let's start with the resignation of Benny Gantz, a key rival of Netanyahu's, and a retired army general. He was thought to be a moderating force in Israel's war cabinet. What does his resignation mean?
You know, on the simplest level, his resignation probably means that in the immediate future, even possibly in the coming days, we'll see this government become more erratic and possibly take military decisions that Benny Gantz and his partner, Gadi Eisenkot, who was also former chief of staff of the army, would never, ever have permitted.
Yeah, elaborate on that a bit more. How could this change Israel's war strategy?
For example, the Minister for National Security, who has called for a forever war in Gaza and for an invasion of Lebanon and for a permanent Israeli occupation of Gaza and resettlement of the Palestinians who live in Gaza out of Gaza and of Jews into Gaza, he's now demanding to take their place in what's called the war cabinet. So Netanyahu may dissolve that war cabinet now that his two partners are gone. But for now, he's facing calls from people who have zero military experience and are really far out there extremists to join and therefore to have a voice in military decision making.
I mean, we'll hear later in the program today a conversation with Lebanon's foreign minister about the current fighting between Hezbollah and Israel on the border. Is there a sense that Netanyahu will take greater military risks now?
I would say that that wouldn't be a surprising development, both because he will be pushed by more extremist elements in his government, but also because he himself, in the last 48 hours or so, has really spoken about a war until Hamas is completely demolished without specifying what that means. And so for Israeli ears, that means months or years of war.
Benny Gantz's resignation came right on the heels of the big news of, over the weekend inside Gaza, the rescue operation that freed four Israeli hostages. How is that news being received in Israel, and what are you hearing about the condition of the hostages after months of captivity?
Well, the news was received with jubilation in Israel. I happened to be in Tel Aviv when the news came through, and you could hear the entire beachfront of Tel Aviv. It was filled with, you know, swimmers and families. It just kind of exploded into a roar of jubilation. Initially, there was really a lot of coverage of this rescue, but I have to say that since then, no one has seen them and no one has heard from the former hostages. And the news that we're hearing here from health correspondents is that while they all appeared to be fine when they walked off the helicopters, in fact, they are suffering significant effects of physical deprivation and emotional torture. There's been a lot of talk in Israel of possible Stockholm syndrome type symptoms, and they all remain in hospital at this point.
Yeah, and the families have released and current hostages are deeply concerned. We'll get to that in a second. I just want to find out, though, Noga, given the resignation of Gantz and the news of the hostage rescue, along with more deaths in Gaza, what is the current mood in Israel?
The mood in Israel is not a good mood. There's this constant sense of everybody asking each other, what do you think will happen? What do you think will happen? Netanyahu made really a massive PR effort to reap political benefits from this rescue, including showing up at the hospital himself, posting pictures of himself with these hostages who had still been in captivity, you know, 3 hours before. And there was an expectation in Israel that he would get credit, that this would boost, you know, his really flagging popularity. His popularity right now is somewhere around 20% and 30%. And that never happened. It simply hasn't happened. The protests against him have grown, if anything. And one of the reasons for this is that, again, in the hours after the release of the hostages, their families began to speak. And they said that the captives had been able to see Al Jazeera while in Gaza and seen the protests demanding their own release, and that that had really buoyed their spirits. Mm. So whereas Netanyahu attempted to use this event to say, you see, only massive military action will save them, and your protests are basically helping the enemy, in fact, their family members said their protests was the only thing that had given them hope.
And it sounds as though the far right in the Israeli government is lashing out at some of those families. I want us to hear a moment from a video that's being shared online. In it, there's a man named Sneer Dan, cousin of hostage Carmel Gatz, still in captivity. And he asks Israeli National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gavir, what have you done to release Carmel today? Let's hear this. And Ben-Gavir replies, stop providing them, meaning Hamas, with fuel. And then he says, stop being a leftist. Noga, is this sort of exchange between Israeli government officials and hostage families typical?
Well, it's extraordinary. I mean, the Israeli government has managed to turn these desperate family members of hostages into basically enemies of the state, and their criticism of a government that has failed to bring home civilians who were stolen out of their own homes by a foreign terror group and haven't been retrieved. They've been demonized. That's the word I'm looking for. Carmel Gatt is a 40-year-old woman. She's a yoga teacher. She's a completely and totally innocent civilian, and her family have been desperate to get her home. And what you see here are the most senior officials of Netanyahu's government. Today, this was his Minister of National Security, simply cursing at these families instead of offering them any kind of help. And that has become a common currency in Israel.
So that's one moment we just heard showing the tension between some families and the Israeli government. There are more hostages still in captivity in Gaza. And I'm wondering, Noga, what with these latest releases, what Israelis are hearing from the anguished families of those still held captive?
What they're hearing is a very specific message that they're very, very grateful for the return of the four rescued hostages, but that the only way to get the 120 hostages who they hope are still alive and in Gaza is a deal. That you cannot send in specific military operations to rescue 120 people being held all over the enclave in so many different places. They want a deal.
Journalist Noga Tarnopolsky is based in Jerusalem. Since we spoke earlier today, the United Nations Security Council approved a ceasefire resolution aimed at ending the war in Gaza. The U.S.-sponsored resolution passed 14-0, with Russia abstaining from the vote. The text supports a three-phase plan put forward by President Biden, which includes an immediate ceasefire and a hostage and prisoner exchange. It also urges both Israel and Hamas to, quote, fully implement its terms without delay and without condition. This is the first time since the start of the war 8 months ago that the UN Security Council has agreed on a ceasefire plan. Elections for the European Parliament this weekend led to political upheaval in France. As the results showed big gains for French parties on the far right on Sunday, President Emmanuel Macron surprised pretty much everyone by announcing a snap election within 30 days. That means voting will take place right before the start of the Paris Olympics. Macron is imploring his country to reject the far right, but commentators say this could backfire for the French president. I spoke earlier with the World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry and started by asking her if anyone saw this coming.
They did not. They did not. It's seen as a massive gamble by Macron, and it might not pay off. I mean, it was a humiliating defeat for his party. But also, this had been predicted, Marco, in the polls for the past few weeks. And we had never heard talk up until this that a general election might be called. I mean, it could be difficult for Macron and his party going forward. They were already a minority in parliament, so it would have been difficult for them trying to govern in parliament with the support for the far right. But certainly this kind of move was not expected. And I was talking to Nasira Ghanif, she's a sociologist at Paris 8 University earlier, and she was saying, actually, this is quite a typical tactic of Macron's.
Macron is a gambler, is a player. It's all about taking the other part by surprise. To him, what is important is to maybe not be responsible for the last 3 years of his government.
Because Macron will stay on as president until 2027, but the next government could be a far-right government with the far-right prime minister. Members of his own party are reported to be furious. The French media said this morning that the prime minister, Gabriel Attal, had tried to dissuade Macron from calling an election last night and had offered to resign himself and was turned down. And on the streets of Paris last night, people were really angry. There were protesters through the city centre last night. Some people were saying what Macron is doing is messing with democracy. Another person who's Muslim was saying that they felt really frightened by all of this. But the way Macron presents it is that this is a sort of an existential choice for French voters. If this is what you want, to be governed by the far right, well, then it's up to you.
Yes. Yeah, so as you said, Orla, calling the snap election, it's a gamble by Macron and could backfire. Could the far right win the general election in France and form a government?
Right now, the polls are saying yes, they could, or it could be a hung parliament. And some people believe that this was actually Macron's gamble, that they win the elections, that they get into power, and then they perform badly. That Macron wants people to see that the far right would fail while in government, that they wouldn't be able to introduce all the changes that they've been promising to voters over the last few years while in opposition, that people will be deeply disappointed by their performance. And by the time the next presidential elections come around in 2027, when Macron himself will have to stand down, then no one will want to see a far-right president like Marine Le Pen take office.
Okay, Orla, so that's France, and what's happening there is a direct result of the election for the EU Parliament. What about the rest of Europe? What does the overall picture look like for the EU today?
Well, it has actually consolidated the votes of the centre-right parties. There was this big fear, as you say, that it would be a surge of the far-right. The surge didn't quite happen, but there were gains for the far-right in many countries. So the two big winners were the centre-right parties and the far-right parties. The way Ursula von der Leyen, the EU Commission President, sort of sold it last night was that this is a big win for the Conservatives, for the European People's Party, as it's known, which is the centre-right grouping in the EU.
Today is a good day for the European People's Party. We are by far the strongest party. We are the anchor of stability. And voters recognized our leadership during the last 5 years.
So one of the big trends, Orla, that you spoke about last week was that green parties would lose a lot of their seats, possibly up to 30%. What did happen there?
They didn't do well. They didn't do as badly as 30%. I think right now the votes are still being counted. The votes haven't all come out. But the general consensus at the moment seems to be that they lost around a quarter of their seats. And there are fears, some climate activists are saying today, that they are worried that some of the EU's climate goals going forward, that a brake might be put on them. You know, right now, last time around, 2019, it was all the talk of the Green Wave. The Green parties were voted in on a sort of huge wave of support at the time. There was lots of climate change protests on the street, etc. But 5 years on, voters are really worried about their pockets. They're worried about the daily cost of living. They're worried about the cost of combating climate change and whether it means a new heating system for them or a less polluting car. This appears to be the issues that's concerning a lot of the voters. And this appears to have impacted on the Green vote. And of course, the far right parties have been very effective in capitalising on all of that.
The World's Orla Barry on the EU election. Thank you very much, Orla.
Thanks, Marco.
Coming up, Americans accused in a plot to overthrow the government in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Three U.S. citizens are facing a possible death sentence in the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
Oui, il est de quelle nationalité?
Where are you from?
I am from Utah in the United States.
Tyler Thompson Jr. appeared in a Congolese military court on Friday. The 21-year-old from Utah is one of three Americans being accused of involvement in an attempted coup in the DRC. It happened last month, leaving six people dead. More than 50 people are facing charges. Some of them could end up charged with the death penalty. Jason Stearns is founder of the Congo Research Group at New York University. Jason, what do we know about this coup attempt and who is behind it?
Well, I think it was very bizarre. That's the most striking thing about this coup attempt. Usually in a coup attempt, you try to do two things. Usually you try to target the head of state and you try to get support from the security services. This one appeared to do neither. A group of ragtag soldiers in mix and match uniforms, but with some sophisticated machinery and weapons, targeted the house of the former chief of staff of the president in Kinshasa a few weeks ago. And they failed to take his house or to kill him. Several of them were killed and they beat a retreat to the presidential palace. And so I think they made a splash on social media when pictures of them at the presidential palace were seen. They took the presidential palace, actually, and they then put up a new flag of the country and they started streaming, live streaming on social media that they were coming for the president and they were going to take over the country. But the presidential palace, as almost everybody knows, it's certainly not the residence of the president. It's not where he is at that time of night. And it's not even really his office, usually. And so the whole thing was bizarre from start to finish.
Who are these U.S. citizens now on trial?
Well, there are several U.S. citizens. The person that we heard from in your clip is one of them. But Christian Malanga is, of course, the person who was at the center of this trial. He's now dead. He's the leader of the coup attempt. And he was killed when the government put down the coup attempt. But he is a Congolese man who became a refugee in Southern Africa. And then eventually his family relocated to Utah. And he spent, I think, a fair amount of his time in Utah. And his son is another one of the people who participated in this coup attempt. His name is Marcel Malanga. So what they share in common is that Marcel tried to recruit several of his friends on his high school football team. So I think some of the Americans came and were recruited by his son into this very botched coup attempt.
Right. So a U.S.-based Congolese politician, his son, and a former teammate from the high school football team. What exactly are they being charged with?
They're being charged with trying to overthrow the government. So these are very serious crimes, obviously, that are punishable by death in the DRC.
As for the basic contours of this story of this coup attempt in the DRC, Jason, you began by saying how bizarre it was. Beyond that, how often have we seen Americans involved in coups in Africa? I mean, that also seems pretty unusual.
Well, there's been a wave of coup attempts or of successful coups across Africa, especially in West Africa and the Sahel region. And some of those coups have involved officers who have been trained in the United States. And there have been allegations that the U.S. has actually been propping up parts of the military that then go and carry out coups against democratically elected governments. This is a different case. Malanga claims that he was trained as an officer or as a soldier in the U.S. Army. It's not clear to what degree that's true or not. He also claims to have been trained in the Congo in the army. But this is definitely a very different sort of situation. U.S. citizens being involved is, I would say, this particular kind of way U.S. citizens are involved, I think, is fairly rare. But yes, there's been a tradition, including in the DRC, going, if we want to go back to the Cold War, of the U.S. being deeply involved in orchestrating coups throughout the African continent.
That was Jason Stearns, the founder of the Congo Research Group at New York University, telling us about the U.S. citizens accused of taking part in a botched coup in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Previously, Stearns worked in Congo for over a decade as a researcher, writer, and UN official. It's a ritual as old as time, gathering around the campfire, a way for people to bond over a meal, tell stories, and share music. These are the things that Ferhad Faisal remembers from his time growing up in the northern Kurdish region of Syria. The world's April Peavy brings us his story.
It was the 1990s, a time before war, a time of fond childhood memories revolving around food. Faisal remembers when villagers gathered around the campfire every winter, a dunuk, or big pot, cooked bulgur wheat.
When we were a kid, this ceremony of making a fire and cooking that wheat was our oral tradition.
This oral tradition included elders in the community telling stories, singing songs. The memories are so vivid to Faisal that he decided to name his band Dunuk. The songs the group sings are some of the very tunes he learned from his elders around the campfire.
This music has a joy, has a love, has so many stories, so we have to share it with others.
These days, Dunuk's music is recorded far from the place of Faisal's childhood memories, far from Syria. Back in March 2011, protests over President Bashar al-Assad's government soon spilled over into civil war. Faisal was in his last year in college, studying in the Syrian city of Homs, when he got the call.
One day, just my father called me and he said, "You have to leave." And next day, I was out of Syria.
Faisal wanted to play music, not fight, so he moved to Istanbul. He brought along his guitar and started to busk on street corners. By 2015, Dunuk was formed. The Kurdish tradition is what binds Dunuk together, with band members from both Syria and Turkey. Most share similar memories of sitting around the fire as the wheat cooked, listening to the same folk songs about shepherds, kings, and maidens. Faisal wanted to learn more about the history of this Kurdish music. That led him to libraries in Berlin and Vienna, where he listened to archival recordings dating all the way back to 1902.
First time I listened to it was like traveling backward in the time, you know, like 120 years ago, some man was singing and some explorer from Europe went there and recorded. So it was really very unique for me.
The songs he heard were recorded on cylinders, sung a cappella. Inspired by these old recordings, Faisal got band members to create their own updated versions using traditional and modern instruments. The result? Their album Warwick, which means pearl. It's a pearl of Kurdish folk tunes for the 21st century. For The World, I'm April Peavy.
Global news and stories are still coming your way this hour. You're listening to The World. London Stadium hosted the Mets and the Phillies this past weekend, and more than 55,000 people showed up for baseball, because who on planet Earth doesn't love the concept?
The history of the world is human beings picking up something round and looking to do something with it.
More on the popularity of the great American pastime in the United Kingdom still ahead here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is back in the Middle East pushing for a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. He's meeting with regional leaders the eighth time since last October. In addition to Gaza, in the north of Israel, there's another concern for the Biden White House that is not going away, the possibility of war erupting between Israel and Hezbollah. The Shia militia has been firing rockets into Israel from their positions in southern Lebanon, saying it's a show of support for Palestinians in Gaza. Israel has been retaliating with airstrikes. The world's Shirin Jafari is in the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Bring us up to speed, Shirin. What is the situation right now with these cross-border attacks between Israel and Hezbollah?
Marco, in southern Lebanon, which is about 2 hours' drive from the capital, Beirut, there are almost daily exchanges. Israel carries out airstrikes and then Hezbollah sends rockets and drones into Israel. And in fact, yesterday we were reporting in the south and we heard two airstrikes, one right after the other. These were not far from where we were reporting and we saw the smoke in the sky. We weren't able to reach these areas, but it was just a reminder of how unstable the situation is right now in that part of the country.
So we're speaking about Hezbollah, which is carrying out these attacks against Israel, but it's not part of the Lebanese military, of course. Where does Lebanon's government actually stand in the midst of all this?
Lebanon doesn't have a government at the moment. It actually hasn't had one for the past 18 months. It has a caretaker government. That's because politicians can't really agree on the makeup of the government. Just a little background here, Marco. Politics in Lebanon is based on a sectarian power-sharing structure. The three main government positions, the president, prime minister, and the parliament speaker, they must be split between a Maronite Christian, a Sunni Muslim, and a Shia Muslim. There's been a deadlock about the makeup of this government for months, and so there is no unity when it comes to its position on what Hezbollah is doing.
And within that government, Shirin, there's the office of the foreign minister, the caretaker foreign minister.
Exactly. I had an opportunity to sit down with the foreign minister, Abdullah Bouhabib. Bouhabib is Christian and he used to be Lebanon's ambassador to the United Nations. We spoke at his office last Friday.
Are you in discussion with Hezbollah about the situation in the south? And what are you telling them?
We are always in discussion with Hezbollah. Hezbollah is a Lebanese party. They are represented everywhere in the parliament, especially. What we're telling them, what we're talking about, that we want ceasefire. I don't mean to say they are not a country. They are not in the United Nations, neither in the Security Council nor anywhere. So it is Israel who will decide whether they want ceasefire or not. And Lebanon is asking a ceasefire. And we discuss these issues with Hezbollah all the time.
Well, Hezbollah has also been firing rockets into Israel.
And Israel has been firing rockets and using the Air Force and using drones to Lebanon as well. Yeah, there is a small war going on in South Lebanon. And I think the Israelis are expanding the war to test Hezbollah, to find out what kind of weapons Hezbollah has.
When you talk to Hezbollah, what do they tell you about what they want? And also, do you have any influence? Does the Lebanese government have any influence over Hezbollah?
Look, their leader, Mr. Hassan Nasrallah, said it very clearly. If this war ends up with all occupied area being liberated, this will be a great achievement. Now, we cannot stop the resistance movement when we have land which is occupied. So it's up to Israel. Implementation of United Nations Security Council Resolution 1701 means that the occupation of Lebanese land would end and would go to the international border, which we agreed with Israel in 1949 under the auspices of the United Nations. We agreed on those borders. We want to go back to those borders. And if we go back to those borders, of course, the Lebanese government would work with Hezbollah in order to stop any the military appearances from south.
Shirin, I'm wondering about the comment there from the Lebanese foreign minister about the Israeli occupation of Lebanon. Help us out with some context here.
Marco, after the war between Israel and Lebanon ended in 2006, the United Nations Security Council issued a resolution which stated that Hezbollah should disarm and stop its attacks on Israel, and that Israeli forces should withdraw to behind what's called the Blue Line. The Blue Line is a demarcation line dividing Lebanon and Israel, and it's not an official border. Today, as we know, Hezbollah has not disarmed, and Lebanon accuses Israel of not fully withdrawing from its territories. And this is what the foreign minister is referring to, these contested areas in south of Lebanon.
Right. Okay. So we know the situation now in Lebanon is pretty tense and people are worried about what happens next. You put that question, Shirin, to the foreign minister.
What are you concerned about when it comes to the situation with Hezbollah and Israel? What are your concerns about what could happen?
You know, we had 15 years of war in Lebanon. And before that, we had some instability because Palestinian refugees were operating against Israel from Lebanon. And the Israelis retaliating very strongly on all Lebanon. And the 15 years of war of destruction, bloodshed was enough for us. We don't want any war. We don't want a civil war. There's a lot of us don't support what Hezbollah is doing in the south, but it doesn't mean we go to war with Hezbollah. Nobody wants to do that at all in Lebanon. No party wants to do that. And the government doesn't want to do that at all, you know. So that's why we like to see ceasefire in South Lebanon. And we hope that the United States would accept to call for a ceasefire in South Lebanon, and we'll see what happens.
Can the Lebanese government pressure Hezbollah to stop?
Hezbollah is more or less retaliating for Israeli attacks.
Whether it's retaliating or not, I mean, it adds to the continuation of the war, right?
There's no doubt about that. Israel is occupying land. And there is a big war in Gaza. And there is a lot of people who feel who are anti-occupation of land. They are in resistance. And they have sympathy for what's going on in Gaza. But if the United Nations would call for a ceasefire in South Lebanon, we'd be sure that Hezbollah would also stop firing at Israel.
How would you do that?
We'll do that. We'll do that. I mean, I'm not going to, if I have the plan, I'm not going to tell you.
Are you going to be asking for help from outside influence on Hezbollah, Iran, for example?
No. We'll discuss it with them. We are all citizens of the same country. We always discuss issues with each other, and we'll continue to do that.
The world's Shirin Jafari speaking there with Lebanon's foreign minister, Abdallah Bou Habib, about his concerns of fighting between Israel and Hezbollah militants in southern Lebanon. Trends in the food industry come and go, with chefs always on the lookout for the next hot new thing. Sometimes that means rediscovering something old. The world's TBS Zaya checked out a happening new restaurant in Mexico City where mushrooms are part of every item on the menu.
Salud.
Cheers.
The welcome drink at Tenkuy restaurant is a deep black cocktail.
Ese viene con mezcal de hongos, una infusión de té negro y un jarabe de huitlacoche.
The server explains it's made with mezcal and cuitlacoche, a fungus that grows in Mexican corn. Tenkuy opened 2 years ago. Its name means connection in the language of the Aztecs.
El común denominador es el hongo, ¿no? De hecho,
Chef Mario Espinosa says the goal is to highlight Mexican varieties of mushrooms in all items on the menu. Each plate is thoughtfully prepared and more delicious than the next. The server brings toast with a mushroom pate, cranberries and nuts. Chef Espinosa's signature dishes include lion's mane dumplings, black pearl oyster mushroom tartare, and of course, tacos with different varieties of fungi. For dessert, shiitake mushroom covered in chocolate with almond paste.
Nosotros tenemos alrededor de 15 15 variedades aquí en el restaurante.
Espinosa explains that the dining experience at Tencuy also includes a visit to a lab in the back of the restaurant where 15 varieties of Mexican mushrooms are cultivated.
Obviamente creamos un microclima, ¿no?
Here they create a humid microclimate in the lab where mushrooms thrive. So the room is dark and it feels a bit chilly. Diners frequently ask if any of these mushrooms are psychedelic.
Es complicado porque al final son es, se vuelve una experiencia o ya.
He says it can be complicated to offer that kind of experience to clients, so they prefer to focus more on the flavor and nutrition side of fungi. Mushrooms are a great source of protein, vitamins, and antioxidants, while they are low in calories and fat. Gina Ray is an environmental anthropologist and a food researcher.
It is estimated that there are over 2,000 edible mushroom species, and around 100 of these are cultivated. So eating mushrooms is one way we can add more diversity of flavors and nutrients into our diets.
But she says in the Western world, there's been an aversion to eating wild mushrooms, especially since colonial times.
The idea that humans were separate from nature became very entrenched, and it was a tool that was used to actually subjugate indigenous populations and destroy the environmental resources that colonists were finding. And now we're really starting to understand that we are wild, everything is wild, and bringing that wildness back is really important.
In fact, Mexico has a long tradition of cultivating and eating mushrooms going back to pre-Hispanic times. Daniel Reyes runs a fungi consulting lab in Yucatan, Mexico. He says there's been a recent push to rediscover ancient traditions of indigenous people in Mexico.
Recipes, you know, ways to prepare the mushrooms, ways to conserve the mushrooms. You know, a lot of this knowledge is being passed down generation to generation.
Mexico has more species of edible mushrooms than any other country besides China. But all over the world, the mushroom mania is taking over. There are festivals, workshops, and major research happening globally. Fungi-focused restaurants are also proliferating in places like New York, London, and Jakarta. So the next time you're looking for a healthy meal, look for a mushroom restaurant because chances are there might be one close to you. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isea, Mexico City.
Major League Baseball is migrating across the pond.
And Castellanos' bat explodes. Are they going to get the runner at home? They're going to get the double play to win the game.
Not often you hear a double play called in that accent. The game was part of the MLB's London series over the weekend. These were official regular season games between the New York Mets and Philadelphia Phillies played on British soil. Michael Clare couldn't be happier about it. He writes about international baseball for MLB.com.
The UK baseball community really stepped up, whether, you know, in an official capacity or just, you know, meetups at pubs for a lot of, you know, English baseball fans. They're there just because they love baseball. So they're wearing Padres jerseys. There is one guy in an Expos hat and an Athletics jersey. So, you know, it kind of had this feeling of, yeah, it's a two-game series for the Mets and Phillies, but really it was a baseball celebration, a baseball party.
I mean, the stadium was not sold out the way it might have been for a soccer match played in the same venue in London. And yet you said the Brits stepped up. What is the British relationship with baseball? Like, how big of an oddity is it?
There are references in 1700s primers to baseball and bat and ball sports. And, you know, obviously there's cricket, there's rounders. One of our writers here, Elizabeth Morator, she just wrote a great story on the history of Welsh baseball, which is this own thing that kind of combines cricket and baseball. And that has a small community. So, you know, it's been around. Baseball was growing in England in, you know, the early 1900s and then really took off in the 1930s when John Moores put a lot of money into it. But there is a league in England, the British Baseball Federation, just like soccer. And there's the London Mets, who last week were playing in the European Cup in Spain.
One big picture question for you, Michael. I mean, you work for MLB.com. You're inclined to be a booster for the sport. Relative to how the game is played and known in the U.S., is baseball really a global game?
I mean, a million percent. This is a game there are people in Bhutan playing baseball right now. You know, the world's last Shangri-La, as it's known, they're playing baseball. There is women's baseball in Uganda that's not only helping women get out on the field, but it's helping them stay in school. There's baseball teams in South Africa. Wherever you go, there's baseball. And there's a great program actually run by the WBSC called Baseball 5. And it's a little modified. You know, let's say you don't have the space or money for all the equipment. Well, this is a version of baseball that can be done in a smaller space. You know, use your hand to hit it. But that's to bring baseball to places that maybe it wouldn't otherwise. There's actually a refugee camp where Baseball 5 is being taught right now to hopefully give some of the people living there, you know, an outlet, a sporting outlet. The history of the world is human beings picking up something round and looking to do something with it.
Michael, what are the most fertile countries you see for baseball's growth?
Historically, obviously Japan and Korea for so much interest, and then Dominican Republic, Venezuela. But we are seeing so much growth across Europe right now. Spain won the European Baseball Championship last year for the first time since 1955. At the last World Baseball Classic, Italy got to the quarterfinals. Great Britain not only was in its first World Baseball Classic tournament, but they beat Colombia. Huge upset, because Colombia is considered, you know, a strong baseball nation. Same with the Czech Republic. That team, other than Eric Sogard and Willy Escala, every player there was developed in the Czech Republic. So we're seeing countries that maybe historically weren't the strongest ones are developing because we're seeing this global reach. So, there countries like Brazil or even Argentina have really burgeoning programs and have so many, you know, great players there in so many different sports that if, you know, baseball grows and is funded, you know, it's coming up in the 2028 Olympics. So this is just a great period for baseball in places where people sometimes don't think there is baseball.
That's Michael Clare. He writes about international baseball for MLB.com. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Every year across the U.S., there are staggering number of drug overdoses. That's in large part because drug dealers are mixing the opioid fentanyl into all kinds of product, from cocaine to counterfeit Xanax. One approach to solving the problem is pill testing, where people submit their illicit drugs for chemical analysis. One state in Australia began pill testing at music festivals in March and then opened up a permanent pill testing clinic in April. But the first place to try it was a clinic in the capital, Canberra. It's called CanTest. The World's Sarah Birnbaum went inside to see how Australia's first testing clinic for illicit drugs works.
I walk up to the clinic on a Friday night. It's in a concrete, nondescript building that kind of looks like the building where my dermatologist's office is.
So it's deliberately, as you saw, quite discreet.
My tour guide is Dr. David Caldicott. He's an emergency room doctor and a driving force behind pill testing in Australia. He leads me into a cheerful-looking lounge area and hands me a waiver.
You can see here, you can take one of those with you.
Great.
So these are our liability waivers. And we're very clear about what we can and can't do. So, for example, no one will ever be told that their drugs are safe.
He says if you want to be 100% safe from any drug, you shouldn't put it in your mouth. I've brought some crushed up Tylenol with me for testing.
We can just place some onto this little glass diamond on here.
In the back room, the chemist, Flynn Attard, taps out some of the powder onto a $40,000 machine called an FTIR spectrometer.
So we've recorded the spectra, we've got the result for this test, and so we say we're highly confident that the major component of the sample we've tested, in this case, would be paracetamol.
There's no fentanyl crisis here like there is in North America, and the lab hasn't found any pills laced with fentanyl. They tend to see MDMA or ecstasy that isn't really MDMA. It's usually another drug like meth, or it's cut with fillers. The staff can identify and quantify those fillers using a second machine, a $200,000 piece of equipment that's the size of a refrigerator.
This is our baby.
They call it Ursula. It can test the purity of a drug, and Caldicott says this machine has been a game changer.
This, the ability to actually measure, say, for example, the amount of ecstasy in your pill is critical.
He says an active dose of MDMA is 75 milligrams. But on the street, there are pills that are 200 and 300 milligrams.
And in a country like Australia, where there's a tendency for people to double drop, if you double drop two of those, you're coming to me in the emergency department.
The concept behind pill testing is pretty straightforward. If you know there's stuff in your drugs that's incredibly dangerous, you're probably not going to take it, or you'll take less of it. The studies on pill testing are limited, but promising. In 2021, a systematic review of 90 different studies from around the world concluded that pill testing does lead to people changing their behavior. Pill testing has been around for years, mostly in Europe. It's just starting to pick up in the US, though only in a handful of cities. And in Australia, pill testing is a popular topic. Every year, there are a string of overdoses at music festivals, followed by calls for drug testing.
It's the first weekend of festival season, and already a young man has died.
According to a recent survey, 64% of Australians support pill testing. Public health experts are behind it, and the Australian Medical Association is on board. And yet, politicians on both sides of the aisle continue to block it in all states and territories in Australia, except for two. Their arguments are some variation of this.
Pill testing gives people a false sense of security. Pill testing doesn't deal with overdoses. Pill testing doesn't deal with the fact that what is safe for one person isn't safe for another person.
Former New South Wales Premier Gladys Berejiklian there in 2019. In the state of Victoria, where Melbourne is, the Greens are sponsoring a bill to establish a 2-year pill testing trial. The Victorian Parliament has taken up this bill 4 times now, and every time it gets shot down. Fiona Patton is a veteran of the pill testing debates. She's a former Victorian MP and a longtime harm reduction advocate.
If I did a straw poll of the Victorian Parliament today, the majority would be in favour of drug checking, without a doubt.
The majority, but not everyone, she says. There's a generational divide.
There will be a small group that are firmly and vehemently opposed. And it will be some of the more powerful older members of those parties who will have the greatest opposition to it.
And it's not that these politicians don't understand or don't support harm reduction strategies for drug use. Victoria has supervised injection rooms for addicts. So does Sydney, by the way. But drug testing, Patton says, that's another story.
So when we have raised this for debate, the problem is that this is not necessarily helping desperate people. This is helping middle-class kids who want to go out and have a good time at a festival or at a nightclub. And that is where many members of parliament draw the line.
But change, if it is coming, is slow. Patton says part of her thinks it would take something like a fentanyl crisis in Australia to give politicians the will to take on changes to the drug laws. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum, Sydney.
In Iran, the slate of presidential candidates is now set for the country's election at the end of the month. Those in the running will be squeezed into 2 weeks of campaigning in their bid to replace Ibrahim Raisi, who was killed in a helicopter crash last month. Iran's Guardian Council approved the country's hardline parliament speaker and 5 others to run for president, continuing the streak of not accepting a woman or anyone calling for substantive change to the country's governance. And while Iran's election is in the news now, critics of the government continue to take big risks in voicing their overall dissatisfaction, both inside Iran and abroad. This summer, the world is presenting an investigative reporting project called Lethal Dissent. It tracks how the long arm of the Iranian government has targeted and even killed critics in foreign countries.
They received these threats via phone calls or text messages. They even threatened his family members in person.
Did he tell you what they would say to them? What kind of threats?
That he would be executed.
That's an excerpt from the next episode of Lethal Dissent coming this Friday. Listen here on The World and catch up on past episodes wherever you listen to podcasts. That's all for this Monday's program. The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Join us again right here tomorrow. One last note before we go. We are grateful that we're the source of international news you rely on. We're able to focus our global reporting on the people at the center of these events because listeners like you support our work financially.
We are fast approaching the end of our fundraiser on June 14th, so if you've been meaning to donate but haven't quite gotten around to it yet, now is the time.
Consider, please, a monthly donation. They are especially helpful in supporting our work year-round and help us plan for a whole year of ambitious reporting. So before this slides down your to-do list, visit theworld.org/give. to donate today.
Your gift will get us closer to our goal of raising $25,000. Learn more and donate at theworld.org/give.
Thank you for being with the world.
From PRX.